Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Mick Power from Quilche tells us why the man in the van fly tipping is causing more damage than just spoiling our view.
People are homing in and becoming far more aware of the value of biodiversity, and the forests harbours an awful amount of biodiversity and is home to an awful amount of valuable habitats. And we can't ruin those, because you will realise, like, you know, especially around the Midlands where you have deep drains, you have those drains being filled with refuse sacks. You can imagine the amount of leakage just going out into groundwater and all that type of thing. And I don't want to be alarming people, you know, but I mean, we all share the groundwater for different reasons, and we need it to be as pure as it possibly can.
Terry Flanagan tells us all about swallows and why they hold a special place in the hearts of sailors.
Although tattoos are becoming fashionable again now, half a century ago, only men, and particularly sailors, had them. And one of the commonest tattoos that they had was of a swallow, often on their hands. Tradition has it that this was to show off their sailing experience. One swallow tattoo signified more than 5,000 nautical miles travelled at sea, and two signified more than 10,000 miles travelled.
And PhD student Kez Armstrong from Queen's University tells us what she's learning from keeping a close eye on kestrels.
They tend to eat a lot of juvenile birds, a lot of juvenile starlings, juvenile robins, all the birds that are hatching at the moment. That's the main diet that they're feeding the young. But in warm days, I'm seeing a lot more amphibians and reptiles coming through, especially on the camera, which has actually provided so many amazing insights into what kestrels are eating during the whole breeding process. So from courtship, when the male is delivering food to the female, through the egg stage, and now obviously rearing the chicks.
So, a very busy programme ahead of us today. And what a busy programme and an exciting programme we had yesterday from 6 to 7. That's where you'll find us live on RT Radio 1, Sundays from 6 to 7. And we do want to hear from you. We want to see your pictures, hear your wildlife recordings, and listen to your observations. So, email mooney@rte.ie. But back to today's programme. Isn't that fascinating what Terry said there about the swallows? Richard Collins is in Malahide. Have you ever heard the like, Richard? Have you got any tattoos yourself?
No, Derek, I've not. I've no tattoo. In fact, when I was young, very few people got tattoos. But tattoos are there a long time, I believe. Captain Cook's men on the famous voyage to the South Seas in the late 1700s got themselves tattoos as souvenirs of their visit.
Tattoos of what? Does it say what they got tattooed?
Well, it does, unfortunately. It says that they got tattoos of ladies. And when they returned to Britain, apparently, when they joined the Navy, the military Navy, shall we say, as opposed to the commercial Navy, they had to tattoo clothes onto the ladies on the men's tattoos.
Very interesting. I'm just wondering, Niall Hatch is in Greystones at his home. Terry says they chose the swallow, and they had one swallow for 5,000 miles, and then two swallows meant that they had covered 10,000 miles. Why didn't they choose the Arctic Tern?
The sea swallow, indeed, that would have been a better choice, because and I'm sure well-travelled though those mariners were, they're nothing compared to the Arctic Tern. It's the longest distance migrant in the world, travels further than any other creature on the planet. Tagging on these birds recently, in just the last few years, has revealed that some of them travel as many as 80,000 kilometres, so it's about 50,000 miles, I suppose, per year, which is absolutely incredible. They breed up in the Arctic and as far down south as Ireland, so we're in their breeding range, and then they migrate all the way down to Antarctica, but they don't travel there directly. The tagging studies have shown what they actually do is travel down along the coast of West Africa, then they turn into the Indian Ocean. They go past Madagascar and the Seychelles and all of those islands until eventually they get to New Zealand, and then they stage in New Zealand for a while and then head straight down from there to the Antarctic continent, where they spend our winter, the southern summer, so they have two summers, and then they return as well, so back to us here. So they see more daylight than any other species on the planet, and they travel further than any other creature as well. So over the course of their lives, it's estimated they travel more than the distance from the Earth to the Moon and back three times, which is really mind-blowing.
So maybe then astronauts have tattoos.
That would do it, yes, indeed.
Anyway, that would be a very good idea. Absolutely. Close to my heart, and I know yours too, and Richard, and anybody else who's a decent, law-abiding citizen of this state, and it has to do with illegal dumping. The most common items illegally dumped in our forest during lockdown, wait for this, include washing machines, beds, sofas, fridges, fridge freezers, household waste, tyres, and building rubble. That is according to Cuilta, the state-owned forestry business, who are custodians of some 7% of our land mass and have spent, wait for this, almost 2 million euro, that's your money, my money and everybody else's money who pays tax, on forest cleanups in the past 5 years. Mick Power is Cuilta's National Estates Manager and he joins us now. Mick, this is getting out of hand. What do we do? Hello to you today.
It's an age-old problem that we have in relation to dumping, except that during the lockdown, the things have escalated to a large degree. Now, it's understandable, given the amount of people that had been using our properties during the lockdown. I think a lot of people got out to explore their local forests. And I suppose a lot of the material that was there was resurrected that maybe we hadn't had reported before. But there's a good deal of stuff out there. And you gave a good rundown of what it was there at the start: electrical goods, household refuse, tires, old furniture, house renovations, all that sort of stuff going on. And as I say, over 2 million euros spent over the last 5 years, which is a substantial amount of money. And given the fact that, you know, in recreation and amenity areas, we're always struggling for cash, that money could have been far better spent on recreation and amenity areas for the public, which we provide to a large degree free of charge. We have an open forest policy. And, you know, to a large degree, our forest policy is love this place and leave no trace. And I would have to say that, you know, 99.9% of people comply very much with that and are very appreciative of our forests and are very complimentary of the way they're kept. But it's the rump that ruled it for everybody else. It's the same as every other section, I suppose, the NPWS, ESB. Everybody suffers in the same way. But it just shouldn't be happening, you know. I mean, the forests we have are forests for nature. Biodiversity is getting a new lease of life and people are homing in it and becoming far more aware of the value of biodiversity. And the forests harbours an awful amount of biodiversity and is home to an awful amount of valuable habitats. And we can't ruin those, because you will realise, like, you know, especially around the Midlands where you have deep drains, you have those drains being filled with refuse sacks. You can imagine the amount of leakage just going out into groundwater and all that type of thing. And I don't want to be alarming people, you know, but I mean, we all share the groundwater for different reasons and we need it to be as pure as it possibly can. And we don't need this level of material being lobbed right, left and centre, here, there and everywhere. That's not where we want to be. And as I say, most people are very compliant and very appreciative of the forest. We like forests for people. Like, I mean, the amount of people that walk. I was in the Cooley Peninsula there recently, and up around the Carlingford side, and the walks that are up there are absolutely mind-blowing. And, you know, the same around the Wicklow side and Avondale. I don't have to tell you about those, Derek. I'm sure you're very, very aware of a lot of the areas that I'm talking about. And forests are going to become very important from a climate change point of view as well. You know, from a carbon sink, you know, it's a no-brainer in that regard. So I think there's an onus on every single one of us to make sure that our forests are kept safe and kept clean. It's as simple as that. We would ask people to bring home their rubbish. If they're coming for a picnic, well and good, we have no issue in the world with that. Come and enjoy the picnic, enjoy the day out. Bring your rubbish home with you. Most people do. As I say, it's the rump, which is in the minority, in a big minority, that don't comply with those type of things. So that's where we are, Derek. Hopefully, whatever little contribution any of us can make, like, you know, to turn that ship around and make people more compliant, you know, everything would be far easier for everybody if that was the case. And money saved as well. And it's not anybody's money, only the public's money, because the public own the forests of Ireland. So when we do things like that, to a large degree, we're spending money from the public purse and to a large degree spending our own money. So we need to be cognizant of that as well.
Niall and Richard, yep. Mick is talking there about the forests being very important as carbon sinks and people getting an understanding of biodiversity. Well, some are, perhaps others aren't. I think we're going to have to put turnstiles on the estates before people enter so we can see what they're bringing in and make sure we know they bring it back out again. But I read a report the other day for some scientists believe that there's no point in planting trees. You're better off putting the money that you might put into planting trees into saving the forests that are already there. What would you say to that, Richard?
We have to do both, really. In Ireland, our tree cover was reduced to 1% in 1900. So in a case of Ireland, you have to rewild it. You have to replant trees. So I don't know who made that comment, but they're probably making it from a country which has plenty of trees already. But we do need to plant more and more, and plant native trees, broadleaf trees, which act as excellent carbon sinks. I think that is important. We have to do everything. That's my attitude.
I would agree, Richard. I think that it's neither one nor the other. I think that we do have to absolutely, as a priority, preserve the forests around the world that currently exist, because, of course, they will then regenerate and hopefully then will spread and repopulate and replant themselves. But, of course, as you said, here in Ireland, we have an extremely low level of tree cover, particularly of native broadleaf woodland, and we definitely need to increase that. That's a very important part of our climate change mitigation measures and also for biodiversity. So much of our biodiversity in Ireland depends on that as habitat. And so it's also a real shame to see that people are abusing our forests and our wilderness areas. It's something that I see a lot myself here in County Wicklow, up in Wicklow Mountains National Park. I'll often be driving up around Sally Gap or somewhere like that. You'll see a fridge freezer dumped into a ditch or at the side of the road. Birdwatch Ireland as well, we manage 20 nature reserves across Ireland, and this fly tipping is a serious problem for us. There's two separate things going on. There's obviously people who are having picnics or are going around and dropping their litter and being very careless about that, and that's a big problem. But then there's also something even more sinister than that going on. There's obviously commercial operations here that are collecting waste, are dumping it in wilderness areas to avoid any kind of waste disposal charges. This is costing charities like Birdwatch Ireland and also the state and state bodies like Quilcha an enormous amount of money to try and rectify that. We're having situations where animals are becoming trapped in these and dying horrible, painful deaths. We have chemicals leaching out, especially from things like fridge freezers, getting into the groundwater. It's a really serious problem. It's something that's endemic all across Ireland, and it really needs to be tackled. We need to see more prosecutions for it as well. It's very hard to find evidence, but we do need to do what we can to track these people down and prosecute them.
I just like to agree with what the lad said in relation to more forests in particular. We have to remember that our forest percentage is at 11%, which is one of the very lowest in the EU. And I suppose the remark that you quoted there probably does come from countries with an abundant forestry. You take France, Germany, Austria, 50 to 60% of their countries is under forestry. And we have to remember we're at 11%. We have great scope for expansion. And I would be a commercial forester. I would have, in my time, planted a lot of Sitka spruce. But it's not just about Sitka spruce. There's room for broadleaves and a lot of broadleaves and a lot of native broadleaves. There's room for all that. We need extra biodiversity. Carbon sinks, you know, we need, for a climate change point of view, if we're going to have an impact, it's going to be through the growing of trees. They are natural carbon sinks. So from the lads' point of view, I would agree with that. We do need more forestry. We need to mind what we have. It needs to be minded all over the world. The equatorial forests are being cut to provide us with timber that we don't really need. We can produce other timber in temperate countries in a sustainable way. And that market can be filled with timber like that. They don't need to cut the rainforest to get a timber supply. But everything has to, I suppose, coexist, the commercial end of it, the environmental end of it. In Quilcha now, we have Quilcha Nature. I'm sure Derek, which you're familiar with, has now come into being, like, you know, where you're going to see the rewilding of a lot of Irish forests, in particular the forests around the Dublin Mountains. You know, that's a response due to population pressure, to the response of people towards the need for amenity and recreation and all that type of thing. You will have a greater, far greater focus on biodiversity and quality biodiversity areas, you know, which really can make an impact. It's a very important move on Quilcha's part to say that Quilcha Nature is in place, and it gives broad recognition to the need and the requirements for you know, things like that to be done.
Can I just ask you, you say you spent over 2 million cleaning up the mess that people have left behind. Would it not be better spent to put manpower or woman power on the ground there to stop them from doing it in the first place and have regular patrols? Or do you already do that also?
No, we do that as well, Derek, yes. And we use technology as well. We are, you know, and have installed cameras in our more problematic areas. Now, we do not want to overdo it because we want people to be able to enjoy their walk in the forest without interference. We do identify where our problematic areas are, and we do work with cameras. We work very closely with the Gardaí and the litter wardens as well. We work hand in hand on the ground, you know, but you have to strike a balance between, we'll say, interfering with people's you know, a right to go and enjoy their walk in the forest without anybody paying any heed or remark to them. And, you know, the need to home in on your problematic areas. And we do that.
Well, it's not likely that somebody who's out for walk make is going to drop a fridge. It's more likely that somebody turns up in a truck or a van and dumps it out. So maybe manpower is the only way forward. I mean, by the time you've caught up with them, if you're just watching them on camera, yeah, they're well gone and you may not get the registration plate.
That may well be the case, that, you know, we'll have to adopt a different approach. But as it stands at present, the man with the van, as you know, have said, the man with the van is alive and well. And, you know, you would like to see those kind of guys being put out of business, because a lot of the problems that we're talking about actually comes from that type of individual. Clean out your garage, 50 euros, you know, that sort of stuff is what happens.
Well, I hate to say it, but I walk quite a lot. I do my 10,000 plus steps a day, at least I try to, and I walk in different areas so I don't repeat the same route each day. And the country, I hate to say it, is filthy. It really is filthy. What is wrong with us in the first place that we do this? And also what's wrong with the city councils, county councils in the respective counties that they can't get out and clean it up? Don't they have enough money? Do we need to give them more money? Do they need to employ more people? What is the problem?
You would wonder that at times, but if you take the example of the Pure project, which I'm sure you're aware of in the Wicklow area, I think a big effort is being made there, you know, through some of the county councils, through the NPWS, through the ESB, through Caolte, and they do a very good job. Now, they do struggle for funds, make no doubt in the world about that, but, you know, they do a very good job. And we have looked at the Pure project very closely, with maybe to try and replicate it in other parts of the country. But the dynamics need to come together to do that. So we've looked at lots of different ways of pulling organisations together to try and, you know, to get that sort of level that the Pure project and the Pure mile and all that has come to in the Wicklow Dublin area.
Well, Mick, we wish you the very best of luck indeed. And thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme and putting out that message.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you very much.
Niall.
It makes my blood boil, Derek. And obviously, I'm sure that regular Mooney Goes Wild listeners are not the people who are doing this. I think the people who enjoy this program are not necessarily compatible with the people who do this kind of horrible fly tipping and commercial dumping. I think, though, it behoves all of us to bear in mind that if we are asking or contracting someone to dispose of materials and white goods and so forth for us, we need to make sure that they're doing that correctly and properly, because the responsibility does rest, and ultimately, I would say, with the consumer and the people who are disposing of these goods. I'd also point out that many of these large white goods, they have serial numbers on them, and there are ways that could be used to track down the original owners of these, and I think that may be something we need to look at more as a nation. This really does need to be stamped out, and I think more peer pressure needs to be brought to bear as well. You know, we do accept this more in Ireland than in a lot of other countries, and that's just horrible.
Yeah, it's a deep cultural thing, I think. As you travel to various countries, one of the conspicuous images of a country is the amount of litter around. There are some European Nordic countries, for instance, very little litter. You hardly ever see anything. Then in southern, more loose cultures, you tend to get an awful lot more litter. And if you go to South America, litter is absolutely everywhere. It's a variation. Now, in Ireland, I think there's a deep hangover from the colonial legacy. I have that feeling about this. This is a purely speculative opinion, of course. But in the old days, power was foreign. It was the British administration, and the attitude to that was to exploit it, to ignore its directives, and to be very hostile to it. And I think that has carried over. You get this resentment of the government, a resentment of authority, which translates into a lot of this kind of antisocial behaviour. There's a very high emphasis on the private property, the ownership, and looking after your own. We have a very high ownership of housing, for instance, in Ireland.
Nothing to do with it, Richard. And do you think people look after their own patch? If everybody stepped outside their door tomorrow morning and just picked up the litter outside their door, regardless of where they live, regardless of whether it's a big house, a small house, a little apartment, whatever, just the litter right outside your front door, the place would be a hell of a lot cleaner. People just don't give a damn.
Do you remember our visit to the Westman Islands off Iceland?
Yes, I do, Iceland.
And do you remember that lady who brought us around? And she would spot very occasionally something lying on the ground. She would go over and she would pick that up. And she was a sort of a waste disposal person. She picked up everything.
And the guys in Norway,
automatically, she wasn't showing off.
Cuvier's beaked whale was beached there, and they had to shoot it to put it out of its misery, and then they opened it up and found all the plastic bags. They were so upset they started cleaning the coastline. The coastline wasn't that bad, but the guys we were talking to were actually crying, grown men crying because of the state of the coastline, because it was a little bit littered.
Yes, and the reason? Because countries further south, Britain and Ireland, it was there. Rubbish, because they showed us the labels on the side of the fish boxes and things that were accumulated in these little bays. They had a huge collection of junk of all kinds, and it was clear that most of that came from outside Norway. They were the victims of bad behaviour elsewhere, I think.
But you're right. I talk to a lot of bird watchers and naturalists who come from other countries to Ireland, and there's many things about Ireland that they enjoy very, very much. We have some amazing spectacles here, some amazing wildlife and biodiversity, but also they do comment on several things. One I always get is the lack of trees, harking back to what we're saying there about the low level of forest cover we have in Ireland, and the other is the amount of refuse in our environment. It really is disgraceful. It's very hard to find, even in a very remote area, a stream or a river that doesn't have some plastic rubbish in it or some discarded refuse. It's very difficult to go to any beauty spot in Ireland where you won't find some sort of discarded oven or hob or something like that. And it's a real, real shame. It's something that we should be ashamed of in this country, and we should tackle it because it's affecting our reputation internationally. And it also gives the impression that we as a nation just don't care, when of course a great many of us really do care, and we need to be more vocal about it.
Well, I care, and you care, and Richard cares, and Mick from Quilche cares, and I'm sure, as you've said, all of our listeners care too. The majority of people care. It's just you idiots who go around dumping. It's so unfair on people who pay their taxes, who go to work, who just want a clean, safe environment to live in, that there's thugs and idiots out there. That's all really I can say about that. Thanks again to Mick. Now, the sound you're hearing now is the loud and distinctive mating call of the natterjack toad, Ireland's rarest amphibian and only toad species. Not surprising, perhaps, that their name means the chattering toad, the jack that natters. And there are plans afoot to make this sound more commonplace in their native range in County Kerry. A breeding programme for the endangered species is currently underway in Fota Wildlife Park in Cork. All toadlets produced under the scheme will be released into the wild to boost the native population. Sean McKeown is director of Fota Wildlife Park, and he joins us now from the natterjack toad enclosure there. Sean.
Yeah, it's our little natterjack nuke corner, whatever you want to call it. And here in front of me there is some little pens that we have, and there's a male clasping on to a female, hoping to breed with her.
So is this the breeding season for natterjack toads?
Yeah, this is the breeding season. We actually already have some eggs that were collected from Kerry, and they are hatching out. So actually the beginning of May, towards the end of April, beginning of May, depending on the temperatures, up until sort of the middle of June.
Now, I've been in the Maharees Peninsula with the late Dick Warner a long time ago, and he made a documentary about natterjack toads, and we sat out in the sand dunes and we heard them calling at night. Have you replicated the habitat there in your little natterjack toad nook? Can you describe exactly what it looks like?
There are a number of actual tubs, large tubs, which have little ponds in them. They have sandy areas, they have mossy areas, and there are lots of areas for them to hide. So the areas that they can lay the eggs. And then on the other side, where we are actually rearing toads, we have a number of tanks that have tadpoles in them. So there's about 1,200 tadpoles here at the moment. Some have actually started metamorphosing into their, they've got little tails on them still, but they've got feet and they're moving around. So as soon as those appear, we take them out of the tanks and then put them in a more mossy, damp in tanks or little enclosures.
Now, I know that natterjack toads are amphibians and they're not reptiles, but I want to ask you a question nonetheless. I remember some years ago when a Kemp's Ridley turtle washed up on Bannistrand in County Kerry, and a big operation was put in place. It even appeared on the Late Late Show to raise some funds and get this turtle repatriated back to the Gulf of Mexico, where these turtles breed. They only breed on one stretch of beach called Rancho Nuevo. And I was one of three people who brought the turtle back. Don Conroy was another, and Gabriel King, who is a turtle expert, were involved in the project. I was just there recording it for radio to give it some publicity. Anyway, when we got to the University of Texas at Austin, one of the scientists told me that these turtles make epic migrations and they were still able to come back to the exact spot where they were hatched when it was their turn to breed. And he believed that they could taste the sand. So my question is, did you take any of the sand from the Maoris to put in your Natterjack nook?
I don't know, tell you the truth. We have just sand that we have locally here in Cork. Whether they can tell the difference between Cork sand and Kerry sand, I'm sure Fungi, who was in the Dingle Bay, then I'm sure that he found that habitat very good for them. It's hard to know if these amphibians would really know the difference.
Richard.
Sean, this is an intriguing, this is a marvellous project, I must say, a very wonderful project that you have started with, I believe, the Dingle Aquarium. Now, I understood that you have six females in FOTA, permanent residents of FOTA, and that you catch some males and transport them up to FOTA and set up a kind of marriage bureau where they cavort, and then you look after the babies when they hatch from the strings. Now, a few things about that. How cooperative are the toads? Are they willing to, the males, for instance, allow themselves to be captured and take up? And will they breed in after that kind of disruption?
Well, we're hopeful they will breed. As far as catching, these were caught by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, so we weren't involved in the actual catching of them. They're certainly getting on with the females that were hatched here in the wildlife park in 2016. They're clasping on to the, when it comes to breeding time, the males actually just clasp on to a female remain there, clasp, all day, all night long. So we have two individuals who are doing that in one of the smaller enclosures, and then we have another one or two males in the second enclosure. We can't see them because they're hidden away, but we're hopeful that they will lay eggs. But one of the main points that about this is the collection of the toad spawn and bringing it here, hatching them, and then releasing them, the toadlets, back into the wild. So last year we released 2,600 into various ponds that farmers would have dug out around their range. So more the outside of the range. And the idea is to extend that range slowly but surely so that they can handle more drought conditions, because I think if everybody remembers last year, at this time of year, we were in a hosepipe ban. It's quite different this year. So last year, there were very few of the ponds that had frogs or breeding frogs in them. Well, this year, I think it's that there's a lot more. But breeding has been delayed a little bit because of the colder weather that we had.
Well, do you send the studs back to the wild when they've done their business here in the FOTA, or are you going to keep them on in FOTA as permanent residents like the females?
The idea is we keep them here. Eventually, we hope to put a public display of toads, natterjack toads, because it's not something that people would see very readily in the wild. As you know, we have a large education program here where we've about 19,000 school children from Leaving Cert and Junior Cert classes, that they come in here and they do a one-day course on ecology and biodiversity and conservation. So it's an ideal opportunity for them to see and experience what the toads look like compared to ordinary frogs.
Sean, I'm just wondering, at what point do you think you will have bred enough of these natterjack toads to release on the Dingle Peninsula?
Yeah, that's a tough question. It'll depend on how well the range expands and how well the actual toadlets that we release survive. So basically, these are going back mainly into ponds that farmers will have dug as part of government funding or EU funding to try and increase the habitat of the available for the frogs. They did try to transfer, initially transfer eggs from one area to another, and that wasn't particularly successful. So they asked us, could we try something here? And it seemed to be quite successful in rearing them. and releasing them at a different age. It's called a sort of the Head Starter program, where they survival rate, normally there's a huge attrition of young when they come out of and during the egg stage as well. So once they leave the water and go into the moist mosses and grasses that are around the sand dunes, they would also be a big loss of numbers. And we take out that sort of normal loss of youngsters, and eventually we're hoping that by having these ponds, the farmers are getting something out of it in terms of an income. The toads themselves are getting new habitat to go into, and that eventually, once the population is big enough, and that could take 5 years, 10 years, could be 20 years, but you know, we are prepared to do it for the long term.
Sean, thank you very much indeed, and good luck with that project. I want to go back to something I mentioned earlier on when we spoke to Mick Power from Quilcha about the illegal dumping. And I mentioned the fact that I had read somewhere scientists were saying that there was no point wasting any more money planting trees. The best thing to do was to preserve what was already there. Well, I've just found the reference. It appeared in Science Daily. And the headline said that some climate activists advocate large-scale tree planting campaigns in forests around the world to suck up heat-trapping carbon dioxide and help rein in climate change. But in a perspectives article scheduled for publication in May in the journal Science, a University of Michigan climate scientist and his University of Arizona colleague say the idea of planting trees as a substitute for the direct reduction of greenhouse gas emissions could be a pipe dream. And in quotes, "We can't plant our way out of the climate crisis," said Arizona's David Breshears, a top expert on tree mortality. It goes on, "Instead of wasting money by planting lots of trees in a way that is destined to fail, it makes more sense to focus on keeping existing forests healthy so that they can continue to act as carbon sinks. According to the researchers, at the same time, emissions must be reduced as much as possible, as quickly as possible." So that's the actual reference. I couldn't remember it earlier on. Niall, you want to say something?
Well, certainly in an Irish context, Derek, that wouldn't hold here, because our native forest cover and native species is so low in this country that even just maintaining them is not going to do enough by any means. We do have to dramatically increase them in this country. However, there's a very strong argument for places like the Amazon rainforest and the Atlantic forest also in Brazil and parts of Argentina, that they're so important as the lungs of the world that we need to do everything we can to preserve those mature forests and all the ecosystems that are based around them, because to try and replicate that elsewhere, to sacrifice those forests and replicate that effect elsewhere, is going to take a very, very long time, and in the process we would lose a huge amount of biodiversity. So I think I really do think it's both options, but for here in Ireland we do need to increase our forest cover. There's just no two ways about that.
Derek, on the question of the turtles are very intimately involved with sand because they lay their eggs deep in the sand, and when the babies hatch out, the composition of that sand could be very important. So the scientists in America who mentioned how they like this sand rather than that sand, that's probably what is driving them. Now, the natterjack does burrow into sand dunes. They do that, but sand is not so much a part of their biology as it would be with the baby turtles. What's important with the natterjack is that the area around the pond has to be closely cropped. So the cattle and sheep cropping it help the natterjack. And they don't like long growth around it for some reason. It seems a very critical kind of requirement for natterjacks, but they have this requirement. The other thing I worry about in this is that in desiccation now, the drying out of ponds is very important now because climate change is heating things up and the ponds tend to dry out more quickly and farmers are digging more ponds for them. Now, the worry about coming along with tadpoles is, will there be sufficient ponds still undried out with room for tadpoles to go into them? Where do the checks and balances apply in this case?
Well, only time will tell, Richard. Now let's move on. Speaking of time, if you look at Birdwatch Ireland's website and you check on the swallow. It says common summer visitors throughout Ireland from mid-March to late September. Well, there are plenty of them about right now. I saw my very first swallow on the 1st of May this year. I know that for a fact because I was getting my NCT done in the car and then I was heading to Cork for the Dawn Chorus, which we were broadcasting from the following morning, May 2nd. Have a listen. Here it is. So that was my first recording and sighting of a swallow this season for 2021, and it was on the rooftop of the National Car Test Centre in Deansgrange in South Dublin. I made a short video and you can have a look because Jarlath, our broadcast coordinator, has put it on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Here's our reporter, Terry Flanagan, to tell us more about swallows.
Yes, Derek, I'm back on the Royal Canal again, but I've moved further inland. I'm not far from Leixlip, and it's a really quiet stretch here, running parallel to the railway. And it's great for wildlife. There's otters, there's kingfishers, there's dippers, not to mention the invasive terrapins that we talked about last year. I haven't seen any of them so far this year. Anyway, I'm here today to watch the behaviour of a returnee. A bird that's been away since last September, and four of them are whizzing around me as I speak. And that bird, well, it's the swallow. And it's not to be confused with the swift. The swift is bigger and he flies much higher in the sky. In fact, the swallow isn't even related to the swift. The swallow is more correctly referred to as the barn swallow. The name has changed throughout history, reflecting its changes in our rural architecture. It was known as the house swallow. There was a time when people actually let swallows into their house and didn't mind them nesting in the house. They were also known as the chimney swallow, but they're now known as the barn swallow. And it's thought that swallows were much rarer before man started to practice agriculture. They generally avoid urban areas, so in cities you'll see the likes of the house martins instead. And their arrival is one of the surest signs that summer has arrived too. But you know the old proverb, Derek? One swallow doesn't make a summer. This suggests caution should be taken in May, as the weather can easily change. Or, as Aina might say, never shed a clout till May is out. So why do they come to us for the summer then? Well, very simply, for food. They feed on insects. If there's plenty of flying insects, then there's an increased chance of mating and producing offspring. Now, traditionally, the swallows return in April. However, our listeners have been letting us know of their first sightings this year. The first sighting sent into the Mooney Goes Wild programme was from PJ Nugent. He took a lovely photo too, and that was back on the 24th of February. And moving into March, Thomas McInallan from Armagh sent in a recording. And then it was Katrina O'Sullivan from County Kerry on the 31st of March, so plenty from all around the country. And then on the 10th of April, Matthew Mitchell, he lives in Liscannor, County Clare. He said that a pair arrives every year to the day. They sit on the electrical cable to the chimney of the cottage. They stay there for the day and then move on. We have several pairs nesting each year in several different outbuildings. And then we moved into April. Lots of recordings in there from the likes of Francie Duff and William and Susan Bonner. So lots of sightings coming in, and they're from all around the country. Now I've moved down to the edge of the canal and I'm watching these four skimming over the water. They never stop. Fly, fly, fly. I can actually see them drinking. They drink on the wing. They also catch insects on the top of the water. Now and again, one seems to belly flop. The belly actually touches the water. It must be for a quick rinse. This skimming just above the water, it allows them to take advantage of what's known as the ground effect, which helps to reduce drag in flight. It's an amazing zigzag flight. They fly at about 11 metres per second, and they beat their wings 7, 8, 9 times per second. And you know the old wives' tale. If you see swallows flying closer to the ground, that's an indication that bad weather's on the way. Well, there is some truth in that. It has to do with air pressure. And when bad weather's on the way, the air pressure will be down, and that means the insects, which they feed on, will be flying closer to the ground. They will perch too, usually on telephone wires. They're commonly seen in late summer, all lining up on telegraph or telephone wires before they head back to Africa. Although we're now familiar with animal migration, this wasn't always so. In the case of swallows, it was thought that they hibernated at the bottom of the sea or in mud at the bottom of ponds. Even Aristotle and Linnaeus believed this. In the 16th century, Olaus Magnus drew that famous picture showing fishermen drawing up numerous swallows in their nets. This was disproved by Edward Jenner. Yes, he of vaccination fame. He wrote a famous paper on bird migration. He noted that when animals like hedgehogs approached hibernation with vast stores of fat, that by the end of winter they were, in his words, exhausted and the animal comes forth thin and emaciated. The situation with migrants, however, is extremely different. In Jenner's own words, if it be examined on the first day of its appearance, it will be as plump and fleshy as any time during its stay. Jenner also believed that swallows and swifts returned to the same locality each year. To test this hypothesis, he captured a number of birds and removed two claws from each, thereby marking them. I doubt that any bird ringers would get away with that today. But he was the first to actually mark birds, albeit in a painful way. Anyway, in the following years, these birds did in fact return to the original location, and one bird, minus its two cut toes, was actually caught and brought in by a local cat 7 years later. It should be remembered that swallows are important in controlling insect pests. They feed almost entirely on flying insects, but they avoid stinging ones like the bees and the wasps. Their favourite habitat is open country with low vegetation, pasture, meadows and farmland, especially if there's water close by. And they can become quite tame, paying little or no attention to the farmer as he goes about his daily business. Although tattoos are becoming fashionable again now, half a century ago, only men, and particularly sailors, had them. And one of the commonest tattoos that they had was of a swallow, often on their hands. Tradition has it that this was to show off their sailing experience. One swallow tattoo signified more than 5,000 nautical miles travelled at sea, and two signified more than 10,000 miles travelled. But going back to the migration of barn swallows was first established in December 1912, when a bird ringed in a nest in Staffordshire in England was caught in a farmhouse in Natal in South Africa. Now that they've been back for a couple of weeks, they'll be concentrating on producing offspring. Swallows have long tail streamers, and it's recently been shown that males have longer ones than females, and it appears that this acts as a sexual adornment. Females prefer males with longer, more symmetric tail streamers. These males with the longer tail feathers are generally longer lived and more disease resistant. One study actually showed that 44% of returning swallows reused the same nest. Imagine travelling back 6,000 miles from Africa to the same nest. And the fancy term for this returning to the same spot is called philopatry. Generally, two broods are reared, but if it's a good summer, they might manage three. Nests are generally inside accessible buildings or under bridges, like here in the canal. Nest building is undertaken by both the male and female, but the final touches, well, they're undertaken by herself. And once the family is completed, it's back to Africa again. How do birds manage to find their way? It's hard to know exactly, but it appears that they use several orientation tools. The sun, the stars, the Earth's magnetic field, and then, of course, their knowledge of the local landscape. Hills, rivers, churches, roads, and so on. For now, it's time to get out and enjoy this tiny but incredible flying machine.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. More details, as always, on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, the kestrel was once a familiar raptor, often seen over fields and motorway verges. Now, it's easily identified because of its distinctive hovering. If you see a bird hovering in the air, it's most likely to be a kestrel. And it's hanging there in the air, seeking out small mammal prey in the undergrowth. It was the most widespread raptor in Ireland until overtaken by the common buzzard in 2002. Who would have guessed that? Now it is on the red list here, with the population down an estimated 53% due to persecution, the effects of pesticides such as DDT, prey availability, agricultural changes and secondary rodenticide poisoning. However, now in what could be a first on the island of Ireland, a kestrel cam has been installed, and you can tune in to the live streaming for the coming months, which will provide, no doubt, valuable insights into this most iconic avian species. The project is a collaboration between a quarry in Fermanagh, Queen's University, and Netwatch. Queen's PhD student Kez Armstrong is based in Belfast, from where she joins us now. Hello, Kez. So I suppose tell us a little bit about yourself and the project first, and then we'll get on to talking about Kestrel Cam a little bit later on.
Yeah, so my name's Kez. I'm a third year PhD student at Queen's University Belfast, where I'm researching the common kestrel in Ireland, although I definitely think it's more of an uncommon kestrel. It's been a really interesting 3 years looking at what's happening with this bird across the island of Ireland.
Well, what is happening? I remember not so long ago when I was driving back and forth to Cork along the motorway, all you could see hovering in the sky were kestrels. I mean, you'd run out of fingers trying to count them.
Yeah, so actually the kestrel used to be the most common and widespread bird of prey here in Ireland. And I think it's quite iconic in that way because it's the first one that most people tend to recognise, or at least the first one that you learn to identify as a child. But unfortunately, in the past 30 years, the population has actually declined by over 53% across the island, which is quite devastating. This is a bird now that's at risk of extinction on the island. It's been recently redlisted, and it's definitely a bird that needs some conservation action.
The species certainly has declined in Ireland. The kestrel is nowhere near as visible as it used to be. Obviously, given its hunting habits, where it hovers so expertly along the side of motorway verges and over fields, people would often spot it, so it would be one of the easier birds of prey to spot. And certainly we're getting fewer and fewer reports of people seeing them. It would be terrible if it disappeared. But Kez, are you seeing a difference in geographic spread across Ireland? Are there some areas still where the kestrels are more common or more successful than in others?
I think yes and no. The problem with monitoring such an elusive bird is that when sighting reports come in, they're going to be coming in areas where people are. So I tend to get a lot of sightings around Dublin, around Wicklow, around the Belfast Hills and the Antrim Hills. So these are areas, obviously, that people like to spend their off time, their downtime at the weekend or on a day off having a walk. And generally that's when sightings are coming through of birds that they're seeing during the breeding season. So you can take it into account a little bit and say that there may be an east-west spread, so that there are more kestrels on the east side of the island than on the west. But they actually seem to be breeding better in the west, and there's a lot more nest sites definitely being monitored in the west of the island, but also the productivity seems to be doing much better in that part of the island too.
Obviously, kestrels are best known for hunting small mammals, such as rodents and shrews and so on. But we have a real paucity of those in Ireland. There's not a big diversity of those species here. So through your work, have you noticed any interesting dietary changes for kestrels? Do you see a different geographic spread with those? And any really unusual prey items that you've noticed?
Yeah, so actually kestrels are a really interesting species to study in Ireland, because this is a falcon that is predominantly a predator of small mammals, and over 90% of their diet in Europe is made up of foals, and there's obviously quite a lot of different species of foal on the continent and even in mainland UK as well. The real difference here is that we only have 4 native species of a rodent-sized mammal for kestrels to eat, and that's obviously our 2 species of mice, pygmy shrew and brown rat. But there are 2 invasive species that have been encroaching up from the southwest of the island, which is the bank foal and the greater white-toothed shrew. And interestingly, in the areas that we see these 2 invasive species, they tend to be popping up a lot more in the diet of the kestrels. So it looks like they have shifted their diet away from birds, which is generally what they've been eating most of, especially up here in the north. Birds would make up the most of the pellet analysis that I've been doing, and shifting to these 2 invasive species, which would be generally what they should be eating, and historically, evolutionarily, what they are eating in Europe and across the rest of the range.
The invasive species that you mentioned, the greater white-toothed shrew and the bank foal, I know that because of their dietary preferences, they're much less likely to come into contact with rodenticides, or so rat poisons, than, say, rats and mice would. Is that having an effect, do you think, on the survival and the productivity of kestrels across Ireland, or is that overstated, perhaps?
Well, we know that poisoning is one of the largest causes of decline of all of our bird of prey species in Ireland. Obviously, it's illegal, and any cases of that really should be reported. In terms of secondary rodenticide poisoning, it is something that is definitely affecting kestrel. It's not part of my PhD research. It's not I really want to look at the fundamental underlying causes of decline and the overall ecology of the bird on the island. It's something that I would absolutely love to have the scope to do, but unfortunately running out of time, I think, now in third year and definitely getting to right up stage and want to get this finished. But I do think the secondary poisoning is something that has been an issue. But again, with the pellet analysis and seeing the amount of birds that kestrels are eating, it might not be as big of a problem as we think, but it definitely needs more research.
Kes, this year has been very cold and miserable. Now, things must breed when their chicks come out, there's maximum food available. Not maximum abundance, but maximum food available. Herons breed very early, not when the food is most abundant, but when it is most available. And they do so because vegetation obscures the prey later on. Now, the same should be true of kestrels and rodents. The rodents are facing cold conditions, and if they come up, there isn't so much cover, so the kestrels should do rather better this year than they would in normal years. Is that the case?
Actually, the really interesting thing that I've found with kestrels and kestrels breeding across the island is that there's a really large range of time when eggs are laid and chicks are hatching. So, for example, in the first year of my PhD, there's a nest in County Down that I've been monitoring for a couple of years, and the young kestrels weren't ready to ring with a BTO ring until the first week of July. Whereas this week at the Manic site, which is the site where we have a live streaming webcam on the kestrel nest, the young were available to ring at 10 days old there on Wednesday. So there's a massive range in timing for kestrel egg laying, and it's something that I'm analysing at the moment, and hopefully we'll be able to deliver some really cool insights into. In terms of diet, I mean, yes and no. So they tend to eat a lot of juvenile birds, a lot of juvenile starlings, juvenile robins, all the birds that are hatching at the moment. That's the main diet that they're feeding the young. But in warm days, I'm seeing a lot more amphibians and reptiles coming through, especially on the camera, which has actually provided so many amazing insights into what kestrels are eating during the whole breeding process. So from courtship, when the male is delivering food to the female, through the egg stage, and now obviously rearing the chicks.
Well, as you've mentioned it there now, Kez, can you please tell us about this Kestrel Cam and how people can log on?
Yeah, so actually Kestrel Cam has been this fantastic initiative. So in the first year of my PhD, because kestrel monitoring typically has been incidental, so we pick up sightings of kestrels, like I said, and when we're out on walks or doing other surveys such as the hen harrier survey or any of the seabird surveys, and even surveying for peregrine falcons, these are the times that we're picking up sightings of kestrels. So they haven't really had any dedicated monitoring scheme. So the first year of my PhD was very much fact-finding and trying to figure out where these nests are, where's going to be the best place to conduct some research, and I got in touch with a lot of quarry companies because kestrels really enjoy quarries. This is obviously a bird that doesn't nest, they don't build their own nests, they prefer cavities, and quarries tend to have a lot of man-made cavities that are perfect for kestrels to nest in. And I was contacted by Oisin Lynch from Manic to let me know that they'd had a pair of kestrels successfully breeding for a couple of years at the quarry. And when I went to visit it last year, it just looked like such a great site to conduct some research on. I actually planned to try and put a trail camera up, and I was asking for permission to put a trail camera up to try and get some insights into breeding behaviour and diet in a quarry environment. But then Oisin decided that wouldn't be good enough, and so he partnered with Netwatch, and they have provided this amazing live streaming camera that's just provided already so many insights into courtship behaviour, breeding behaviour, egg laying, and now obviously rearing the young. And we've dubbed it Nestflix because I think it's actually taken everybody by storm, and I'm certainly addicted to watching it and really looking forward to getting some analysis of some of the results coming through. It's been such a wonderful project to be part of. It's a really collaborative work, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to do more of this in different quarries and maybe build up an idea of what's going on with kestrels all across the island.
Well, Kez, we wish you the best of luck indeed with Nestflix. You can find all the details of how you can log on by visiting our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Richard Collins and Niall Hatch. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland, and our researcher is John Bellarotti. Don't forget, you can hear us live on Sundays from 6 p.m. right here on RTE Radio 1. Until next Sunday, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.